All rise. The Court of Appeals of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Judge Bulla presiding.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. I'm Chief Judge Bonnie Bulla of the Nevada Court of Appeals, and with me are my colleagues, Judge Michael Gibbons and Judge Deborah Westbrook. This is the date and time set for oral argument in the Consolidated Appeals, number 86961 and 87975, in the case of Smith v. Poston. I believe today we have Ms. Allen for the appellant, and then we also have Mr. Meyer for the respondent. Each party is limited to 15 minutes of argument. Ms. Allen, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Very good. We'll reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before we get started, the court recognizes that there are several issues to be addressed in these consolidated appeals, and we would generally like counsel to be prepared to address the effect of Mr. Poston's passing on this appeal, particularly as it relates to mootness. We would also like to hear from counsel regarding what a new trial would look like without Mr. Poston as a witness. Regarding from the appeal from the award of costs and interest, Ms. Allen, please specify exactly what relief you are requesting from this court. And Mr. Meyer, please be mindful that you did not cross appeal, so you need to just respond to Ms. Allen's arguments. We are also cognizant of the fact that because of the number of issues, we may need to extend the time for argument, but for now, each side, as I indicated before, has 15 minutes. We're now ready to proceed. Ms. Allen, you may approach the podium.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Last year, this court in the Hayes versus Watson case found that in some cases, it's only by considering the cumulative effect of individual errors that the unfairness of a trial can be fully appreciated. And that's what we have in this case. We have cumulative errors that added up into an unfairly prejudicial trial against Ms. Smith, particularly hindering her ability to present claims for punitive damages. The unfortunate passing of Mr. Poston has limited the remedy that we can have, but just because the remedy in this case is not a perfect remedy or an ideal remedy does not mean there is a remedy nonetheless. In this case, the remedy would be to allow us to have the additional relief that we initially requested when the court denied our request to have him appear for trial testimony, which would be to allow us to present the recorded statement that he presented to his insurance company shortly after the trial or shortly after the crash, and the portions of his deposition that were excluded that relate specifically to punitive damages. The reason that evidence was so crucial in that case is because punitive damages require a showing of conscious disregard for both malice and oppression. Conscious disregard requires us to show that he had knowledge of the probable harmful circumstances and willfully and deliberately failed to act to avoid those.
Ms. Allen, let me ask you this question. What do you believe in his deposition transcript or in the statement he gave to the insurance company would prove or assist in proving implied malice?
With respect to his recorded statement, on page 132 of the record, he indicated that he didn't have a valid driver's license at the time of the crash, but that he had one and it was suspended, indicating that he felt he needed to lie, because we know from his deposition testimony, in contradiction to his recorded statement, he stated that he had never had a driver's license. He had never taken the test to have a driver's license. He had minimal driving experience and training. He had never had any formal training, and his behind the wheel was limited to roughly 20 times from the point he first learned to drive. He had never driven alone. He had essentially just driven down the block to the store and on vacation.
Let me ask you about the statement itself. The only way in which you requested that you be permitted to use the statement was for impeachment purposes. Is that right?
That's true, but we also, with respect to his punitive damages. So the jury was instructed that if they believe he has lied about any material fact, they can consider that and disregard any additional testimony. And the jury was also instructed that they can make reasonable inferences based on their common sense. It is a reasonable inference for the jury to conclude that by lying about the fact that he had a license, claiming that, oh, I had one, but it was suspended, that he knew that he shouldn't be driving. He knew that he was an unsafe driver. We know that he knew he didn't have sufficient experience, training. He had no formal training, limited informal training. And so a jury could disregard the testimony, even about the limited experience he had, and find that he knew he'd had no experience.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but how do you plan to get that statement into evidence?
With respect to the two portions of the recorded statement we wanted to get in, we would just read it in, similar to we did with his deposition testimony. And we would just like to address additional portions of his deposition testimony to contradict that statement. It may look differently at a new trial. Maybe we would just read it in initially and then have his deposition testimony read in afterwards, rather than what we did in the initial trial, which was have portions of the deposition testimony read, then attempting to introduce his recorded statement.
Counsel, it sounds like your best case scenario. All we have is Mr. Postian's discovery deposition testimony and the recorded statement. If we remanded for a new trial, allowed the jury to hear all of that, how would the outcome change?
Because we would be able to have evidence that he had knowledge of the probable harmful consequences of his actions, that he wasn't safe, he wasn't fit, he shouldn't be driving, and he didn't have the qualifications to drive, even if he didn't have a license.
But didn't he state in his deposition at some point that the reason he got behind the wheel is because he was the only sober person?
The fact that he was the only sober person doesn't make him safe. It doesn't mean he knew what he was doing. We know he didn't.
That suggest an absence of malice?
It suggests that he wasn't malicious and he was trying to drive people around, but he still had knowledge of the fact that he wasn't trained and fit. And that goes to conscious disregard, that he knew he wasn't safe. You know, he knew he shouldn't have been driving, and that's exactly why he lied in his recorded statement and said, oh, actually, I do have one. It was just suspended. The fact that he had a license would indicate that he had some training, and it would be reasonable for somebody who is taking his recorded statement to find that in by claiming he had a license, but it was suspended, at some point in time, he had training needed to get the license. But we know in actuality, he had never had that.
Didn't the jury hear that evidence, though? Didn't they hear the fact that he did not have a license, that he did not have any formal training?
They heard portions of it. What they didn't hear is that he said in his recorded statement that he had a license and it was suspended. And then later on during his deposition, he lied and said, well, I've never told anybody I had a license and it wasn't suspended.
How does that demonstrate that he had malice at the time of the accident?
Because he's lying about having a license. He knows that it's wrong to not have a license and drive. And he even says in his deposition, I know I shouldn't drive. I would agree that I shouldn't drive a vehicle if I don't have a license. And so by lying, when he's certainly giving a statement shortly after the crash, he's showing that he knows he shouldn't have been doing what he was, which was driving without the knowledge, the experience, and the legal right to have a license or to be driving.
Let's say we agreed with you that the court erred by not requiring Mr. Postian to testify at trial. Now that he's dead, he can't testify, correct?
That's
so correct. That remedy, he can't have a new trial, or she can't have a new trial where he testifies. Would you agree that that remedy is now off the table? And that was primarily what you were asking for in your appeal.
That's correct. Again, though, we do have the ability to introduce the recorded statement and the testimony, which we weren't allowed to present in the first trial. So again, even though it's not a perfect solution, it would have been nice to have been able to get it the first time around, but there still is a remedy, which would be introducing the additional exhibits.
So you've argued for the mootness exception to be applied in this case, if we assume we find that this is moot. But that exception requires us to find that there is only a short window of time to challenge a particular type of action before the issue becomes moot. So the type of cases where the exceptions applied, things like bail orders, temporary guardianships, non-competes, those all tend to be temporary, difficult to challenge before the issues become moot. Would you agree that the issue of when an incarcerated party can be forced to testify in a civil trial is not the type of issue that's typically short-lived and that quickly becomes moot?
I don't think there's necessarily a way to say either way that it's typically an issue that could be moot quickly or not. But I mean, obviously in this case, we have an issue of somebody who passed away while he was incarcerated. If we aren't able to get through the process of actually bringing him in, incarceration prevents a barrier. It means it's going to make the time in order to get their testimony longer, therefore increasing the possibility that they might in fact not be available at a later date.
But if he hadn't died, we wouldn't be talking about mootness, correct?
I would say that's correct.
Ms. Allen, is there anything in the Nevada revised statutes that driving without a license and or without formal training entitles an injured party to punitive damages?
There's nothing specifically laying that out, but the fact that there isn't a Nevada revised statute indicating it's a crime, indicating that there is a specific remedy for punitive damages, isn't where the analysis ends. There's a lot of times that punitive damages are appropriate where there's not a specific statute tying in why what the actions were illegal or were a crime.
If I understand correctly, your position is that if the entirety of the deposition were read to the jury and if the entire insurance statement were read to the jury, that would demonstrate that Mr. Poston had been lying about the circumstances or what occurred, and that equals implied malice?
It's something that the jury can infer based on their common knowledge, their common sense, their experience. Why would somebody lie about having a license if they knew that it wasn't safe to do so? To drive without a license.
So you believe just because Mr. Poston may have lied or did in fact lie, that constitutes malice, implied malice?
Not just the fact that he didn't have a license. We know the fact that he didn't have training. So it's not just that he lied. It's the fact that he lied about it and he had no training, no experience.
I think it was no formal training, correct?
Correct.
He did practice with his father.
Correct.
He did testify to that.
You have 5 minutes left for rebuttal, but before we give you that time, I do want to ask you what remedy you want in the consolidated appeal with regard to the costs and interest.
Two very specific things. First, and it doesn't seem to be at this point disputed, it was previously but no longer is, that Ms. Smith is entitled to, assuming there is no new trial issued, if Ms. Smith is entitled to prejudgment interest from the date of the complaint being served to the date of the offer of judgment, which would amount to $12,293.81. The second issue for the interest appeal is that the interest on Mr. Poston's cost was improperly calculated. It needs to be calculated from the time the costs were incurred to the date of the judgment. In this case, all costs, the interest was calculated for all costs, regardless of the date they were actually incurred, from the date of the offer of judgment until the judgment, which was 1,010 days. So, and a majority of those costs were incurred less than 30 days before trial. So it was an inappropriate penalty to Ms. Smith on the amount of interest that she would be expected to pay.
Does Rule 68 specifically indicate that the costs have to be, the interest on the cost has to be levied when they're incurred?
It doesn't specifically outline that, but in the Ghibellini case, which is indicative of, which relies on NRS 17.130, which is what their request for costs was based on, in the Ghibellini case, they very clearly stated interest on costs should run from the time when the costs were incurred, and they found that NRS 17.130 did not speak to damages that occurred between the service of the summons and complaint and the judgment. We reason that the legislature did not contemplate this problem and would not want to permit damages to bear interest from the date the complaint was served, even though they were actually incurred sometime after the service of the complaint. Same thing with NRS 68 or NRCP 68. even though it's not specifically outlined that they should run from the date of they were actually incurred, it's reasonable to assume that the legislature wouldn't want to unfairly punish somebody just because they didn't rejected an offer of judgment.
68 is a court rule, so it's not the legislature. In this case, the plain language of 68F says that the interest on the judgment runs from the time of the offer to the time of the entry of the judgment without regard for when the costs or expenses are incurred. So why wouldn't we go with the plain language of the rule rule as opposed to a case that's interpreting a different statute?
Because again, you have to look at the purpose of NRCP 68. NRCP 68 was designed to encourage settlement, not punish. And by starting the interest from the date of the offer of judgment, rather than the dates that the costs were incurred, you're punishing for something that doesn't really exist. There was no interest accruing at the time of the offer of judgment for a cost that was incurred 10 days before trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Meyer?
Good afternoon. I'm going to address some of the arguments that were just proffered. I'm going to start from the most near one and move backwards if I can. Clearly, the plain language of Rule 68 provides for the award of costs from the time that the offer is rejected. I would say that the intent of the rule is actually a cost shifting mechanism by which the intent of the rule is actually to require that parties recognize the implications of rejecting an offer or not rejecting an offer as it relates to the incurring of costs moving forward, regardless of when they're incurred before trial. That's the whole purpose and the intent of the rule is to get the parties to identify, to take ownership of their cases and to manage that risk as it relates to costs that they may have to incur depending on those choices that they make.
Well, Ms. Allen makes somewhat of an interesting point that it's hard to levy interest on a cost that has not yet been incurred. So how do we reconcile that?
Well, and that's why that analysis is done after trial. Once a judgment is entered, the court then looks at the costs that have been incurred at that point in time and looks at whether they were incurred vis-a-vis the timing of the offer of judgment. And at that point in time, it's simply a mathematical calculation as to, because they're all incurred by that time, at the time that the court then retroactively applies the prejudgment interest. The appellant in this case, it's really important, I think, to identify for purposes of the punitive damages in this case, what was the conduct that is required to be punished? What was the conduct at trial that was intended to be punished that the plaintiff was intending or asking the court for the jury to consider? And that was the conduct at the time of the accident, not the conduct or the inconsistent statements or the potential lack of memory or whatever the reasons that may have existed for inconsistencies in trial and litigation. Punitive damages are not intended to punish that. They're intended to punish the conduct giving rise to the injury. And in this particular case, that is the motor vehicle accident, the conduct occurring that leads to the accident. And Nevada law is very specific as to what that has to be. It has to be accompanied by fraud, oppression, or malice, either implied or explicit. It's very important to remember that in Nevada, that's a very high standard in terms of implied malice, because that is the mechanism by which the plaintiff in this case sought to seek punitive damages, is that the conduct associated with the accident was accompanied by implied malice. That has to be far more than even recklessness. It has to be far more than gross negligence. And what the plaintiff and the appellant in this case is asking this court to do, essentially, is to equate not having a driver's license with being a dangerous driver. There are three pertinent facts that the plaintiff, the appellant, relied upon and presented to the jury for the basis to try to establish implied malice. One, that Mr. Postian didn't have a driver's license. Two, that he didn't have formal training. Or three, and three, that he didn't have as much, he didn't have tons of experience driving. So what the plaintiff, the flaw in the analysis is that the plaintiff, the appellant, is seeking to equate those with conscious disregard for the safety of others. Just because, and I would argue that people in this community get into accidents every single day, multiple times, and they're all licensed. It doesn't prevent them from being safe or not. The fact of having a license doesn't rise to that level of implied malice that's required under the statute. It doesn't rise to that level. And that's what this court looked at, the facts that were presented. And there was information and evidence presented to the jury in the form of the deposition as to what constituted the punitive damages in this case. The reason why the recorded statement was sought to be introduced was not to show that Mr. Postian didn't have a driver's license, because that was already in his deposition. It was already presented to the jury, and that was the conduct at or near the time of the accident. The reason the recorded statement was sought to be introduced was because Mr. Postian merely had inconsistent statements. And what the appellant thought to do was essentially to call a witness who wasn't there to impeach him, to make it look like this is a bad guy, he's lying, you can't believe him, and therefore we should punish him.
Well, counsel, wasn't the reason that Mr. Postian wasn't there because you guys objected and essentially told the court, hey, he can't testify, nothing he has to say is material, it's too prejudicial? But I guess my question is, even though he conceded liability, wouldn't his trial testimony have been material on the mental state necessary for punitive damages? And if his incarceration was so prejudicial, why was it brought up by his trial team?
Well, it wouldn't have been material as to his state, because that information, the information that existed at the time, was already there. In fact,
So it wouldn't have been proper for plaintiffs to cross-examine him and ask him about his mental state at the time of the accident? That wasn't something that they could ask him at trial?
Well, in fact, his deposition, those questions were asked during his deposition. And in fact, and that's why I think that's why the court, it was an error for the court to conclude that his testimony wasn't necessary. First of all, the two aspects of the trial that were in dispute, causation and damages, his involvement in the trial added nothing to that. It was completely irrelevant to that. And the court concluded that the conduct that even on its face allegedly gave rise to implied malice wasn't sufficient enough to give rise to it anyway, based upon the testimony and all of the information in the deposition. In fact, in the deposition, he testified that the reason why he got into this accident because of the sun glare, not because he didn't know how to drive. All of these things were explored in the
deposition. Doesn't that make his credibility crucial right at that moment in time, if he's lying about how the accident actually happened? He could just say it had come up with that excuse later. So he's approaching an intersection. The sun's in his eyes. What was his driving like? Did he slow down? Was the sun really in his eyes? Did he speed up to make it through, to beat a change of light? His credibility is now at issue, and whether he's telling inconsistent statements about it now becomes more relevant.
It is, but liability wasn't at issue. His credibility as to how
the— As to punitives,
but as to liability, no. The reason why the credibility, it's never been alleged by the plaintiff that the way he was driving rose to the level of implied malice. That's never been the allegation. The allegation is that the implied malice is that he didn't have a driver's license. He had admitted that. The allegation is what rose to the level of implied malice was that he didn't have formal driving training. He admitted to that.
As you started out your argument, you said it was the facts of the accident. That moment in time is what we should focus on. And the facts are that he went through a red light and struck somebody in an intersection. That's not normal driving. Did he lie about why he did that?
No, but
his credibility is at issue on that particular point. And so you're looking at the whole picture of the accident. What were the circumstances of the accident? How did he explain it? Is he believable? Whether his training may have had some, lack of training may have had some effect on it.
And that information was presented, like in other cases, when a witness is not available. It was presented through Rule 32. It was presented without him needing to be there. And the use of the deposition could be used for that purpose. And in fact, in this case, it was.
Well, Mr. Meyer, that's not exactly correct, because there were a lot of testimony that was redacted. Anything that was contradictory to his statement to the insurance company, the district court allowed the parties to redact. I don't know if you can point me to a place in the record where his testimony that he ran the light because his son was in his eyes actually came into evidence at the time of trial. It appears that that might have been one of the sections of his testimony that was actually redacted. So is it fair to state that the jury may not have heard everything that you are now explaining an oral argument would go against a state of mind for punitive damages?
And Your Honor, I believe you're correct that it was not admitted into evidence. As I sit here today, I can't tell you off the top of my head whether that specific portion was redacted in a recorded statement. My belief is that it was testified to in the deposition, and the appellant chose not to introduce that into evidence.
Well, wasn't the reason for that is because the district court would not allow the statement that was prepared by the insurance company to come into evidence?
I don't want to erroneously lead Your Honor, because I don't specifically remember that piece of evidence off the top of my head. So I don't want to mislead the court or make a misrepresentation about that. What I believe the court concluded that potential information wasn't relevant because liability had been admitted, and it wasn't an issue for the jury to decide at that point.
Could you point to us in the record if there is any information in the record as to when the parties first learned of Mr. Postian's incarceration?
I know it was before trial. And I cannot tell you that as I sit here today, Your Honor.
Would it have been after the joint pretrial memorandum was filed? Because there was no indication in that memorandum that he would not be testifying at trial.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, thank you.
I apologize. I don't remember, and I don't want to miss
it. What was the court's rationale to exclude him, essentially all forms, in person, by video, by telephone, full deposition, the recorded statement? I mean, just about everything was kept out.
I believe, Your Honor, that the rationale was that the only issues in dispute were causation and damages. Liability had been admitted. And it wasn't as though there was not going to be evidence of Mr. Postian's testimony about what happened. He had been, in fact, deposed, and he allowed the appellant in this case the opportunity to present that testimony to the jury in the form of his deposition. So I believe that was the rationale.
Essentially that it was irrelevant, unnecessary.
Well, certain parts, I think that the trial court judge did think was important and gave plaintiff leeway in terms of allowing portions of that deposition to come in. Over our objection, I believe, because I think our position was that liability was determined. It doesn't matter. It's not for this jury to determine, you know, whether he was negligent or not. So I think that was actually over our objection.
So under Rule 50A, a directed verdict is not permitted unless a party has been, quote, fully heard on an issue. can you really say that Ms. Smith was fully heard on the issue of punitive damages without an opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Postian at trial in front of the jury and confront him with his inconsistent statements and inquire into his state of mind?
Well, to the extent that the rules allow the presentation of evidence through a deposition, yes. Could the court have ordered him to be present? Yes. The legal issue, though, is was it error to not under the rules? And I think under Rule 58A, there can be a disagreement about whether that was allowed or not, given the fact that the plaintiff, the appellant, did have the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Postian in the form of his deposition. And all of those inconsistencies, all of the alleged inconsistencies that supposedly existed in the recorded statement in the deposition, it would all have inured to the defendant's benefit. Meaning if he at one point had a license, that would have inured to the defendant's benefit, not the plaintiff's benefit. So the evidence that inures to those claims in the light most favorable to the plaintiff was all of the things that were presented in the form of that deposition.
Well, Mr. Meyer, the one concern that was set forth in some of the briefing was that the defense indicated to the jury in closing, it would have been nice to have had Mr. Postian here. We would have loved to have had him here. So with that in mind, why did the defense object to some alternative means to bring Mr. Postian to trial? Even if it wasn't in person, there were a lot of other options available. Why object?
Well, I think there was a host of reasons why we objected. One, we didn't believe it was relevant to any issues in front of the jury. Two, we didn't want the jury at the time suspect or know or have information that he was in prison.
But didn't counsel advise the jury of that pretty early on in the case that he was incarcerated?
Yes, but we weren't allowed to talk about why. And we had to get out in front of, we had to talk. And those things, I should say, are argument by counsel. Those things were argument, and they were based upon evidence of a whole lot of tangential evidence that played into arguments of counsel, not specific evidence that was, through a witness or
they were strategic.
They were strategic decisions, absolutely.
Right, but did the district court make any oral or written findings on each of those points?
On which points specifically, Your Honor?
I haven't seen any order in the record, so there's no written order, so I'll answer my own question on that. So are there oral findings on the various parts of the defense objection to the witness appearing? Or did the court just state generally, I agree with the defense, not allowed, as to every option that was presented?
I can't sit here, Your Honor, now a couple years later and tell you with any degree of certainty the nature and extent with any specificity as to what the court ordered orally or what comments he may have made orally.
And it's important because of the standard of review is we defer to factual findings, discretionary calls, but if a court doesn't really state its reasons, then it's hard to extend the discretion in the same way as when the court does state its reasons.
Understood. And the best I can do is tell you that my recollection of the rationale for the order was that Mr. Postian's deposition had been taken. All of the evidence that had ever been alleged to support a finding of punitive damages was in fact presented to the jury. All of that was presented. And what the court concluded was that information, all of those facts, they simply under Nevada law do not rise to the level of implied malice, the high level above recklessness, above gross negligence. And one of the implications that I specifically remember articulating is that allowing evidence of a person not having a driver's license would therefore, the impact that that would have on all cases in Nevada would therefore, even for individuals that are making claims, if they don't have a license, now those individuals can be challenged that they're actually engaging in implied malice simply by being on the roadway because they don't have a license. It opens the door now to, you know, if this court were to hold that not having a license rises to that level of implied malice, that would then potentially allow all parties to challenge whether people are, whether essentially having a license is evidence of being a bad driver or being a dangerous driver.
Would you say the same thing if it was a plane crash where the pilot didn't have a license?
Well, I don't know the, you know, I don't have the qualifications to know, you know, how planes operate, how, I mean, that's far beyond my grade. So, I understand your point. I understand your point.
You're making it's a general rule that the Pandora's box would be open, but for every rule, there's always an exception, isn't there?
There might be, but if the legislature hadn't specifically intended the lack of a driver's license to rise the level of punitive damages, just like it does alcohol consumption in a vehicle, it would have, it could have and would have clearly stated as such, I believe.
One final question, if I may. And I'm wondering, I don't know that you've addressed the mootness issue, and counsel has indicated that even though Mr. Postian has passed away, there is still a remedy that could, you know, that we could apply to that particular error. How do you respond?
Sure. The mootness of the issue, particularly as it relates to
his trial testimony, whether he should have been called as a witness at trial.
Right. Understood. So clearly, I believe, obviously, that issue is moot now. And because that remedy cannot be provided, you know, within within a even within a cumulative error analysis, because it is moot, this court cannot and should not consider that as part of a cumulative error analysis. And while there is no Nevada court that specifically provides for that, federal courts in multiple circuits, including the Ninth Circuit, the 11th Circuit, and I have those citations, but multiple federal courts have held that for purposes of the cumulative error analysis, that if a issue becomes moot, it cannot and should not be considered and must be dismissed for purposes of a cumulative error type of analysis. Now,
outside of cumulative error, I'm mainly asking about the remedy. Okay. Is there another remedy that we could offer for that error? As you know, your colleague on the other side has suggested, it doesn't necessarily have to be him testifying, which because he can't.
Right. Understood. The answer is that no other remedy really exists because the information that was used to try to establish the punitive damages was admitted. It was already admitted. So there can't be another alternative for information that the jury and the court already heard. Now, I understand there's an argument, well, the recorded statement could be admitted because it shows inconsistencies in his statement. But again, the recorded statement, first and foremost, it's not a deposition. So I'm not sure it can just be read into evidence on remand. There's evidentiary potential objections to that. It's not a deposition under Rule 32 that can be used for any purpose, okay? But again, the issue of the recorded statement goes to inconsistent statements, not to the malice that existed giving rise to the accident or the implied malice giving rise to the accident. It goes to, you know, we don't like this guy, we don't like this witness because he's telling us two different things at two different times. So while that is a remedy, it's not a remedy that gets to the heart of what the alleged error is. And that is whether or not this conduct rises to the high, high level of implied malice. And that's the that really is the fundamental issue in this case, is whether these things, these facts, not whether he later said something different about them, but in order to the plaintiff's benefit, assuming that they're true, giving all that benefit to the plaintiff that he didn't have a license, that he didn't have a lot of experience driving, that he didn't have formal training, This court concluded those things didn't, they simply don't rise to that level under the punitive damages statute. And they don't exceed mere recklessness or even gross negligence.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you.
Ms. Allen, you will have some additional time. I'm going to go ahead and give you an additional 8 minutes if you need it, in addition to the time that you have left on the clock, which I believe was 1:38.
Unless you have any specific questions, I'd like to start with where Justice Westbrook just left off, which is about additional remedies. While ideally, again, we would like to have his testimony, the best alternative would be, like we mentioned, the reported statement or the portions of the reported statement. We don't even need to bring the entirety of the statement in, just the relevant portions we indicated, as well as his deposition. There potentially is an additional remedy of additional discovery. We could depose his father. I believe his girlfriend was listed as a witness, the one who was in the vehicle with him. We may be able to depose her and get testimony that might be indicative of what his mindset was at the time he picked her up, at the time of the crash. So it's not just the recorded statement of the deposition. We could potentially pursue other avenues with additional discovery, which weren't necessarily something we were going after the first time around because Mr. Poston was still fortunately alive at the time. With respect to the question as to why he wasn't presented for trial, the order, I believe that was just your question, whether the order actually specifically states the reasons why he wasn't. I do not believe it does. I will refer you to that's volume two of the record, pages 438 to 439. I'm sorry, 449. That's specifically where that oral decision was made. And it essentially, to my recollection, was he's not going to appear, but you can use the recorded statement and the deposition. And so the caveat of him not being there was that we could use the recorded statement and the deposition to impeach him on the issue of punitive damages. That was specifically raised during that argument. And ultimately, we weren't allowed to do that at trial. So that alternative ultimately didn't come to fruition.
Ms. Allen, did you attempt to get the statement in for another purpose besides impeachment at trial?
I believe that it was just at that point was for impeachment, but also to, I mean, it was to show that he, you know, had this mindset, but it was predominantly for impeachment at the time.
So you used the hearsay exception for a prior inconsistent statement. That was the hearsay exception that you cited to the court at the time.
Correct.
And that's the only one you argue on appeal?
I believe so, yes. With respect to the alternative means of having him be presented, I do want to point out that there was issue of prejudice that was raised, that he was incarcerated and it would make him seem like a bad guy just because he was in jail. We absolutely proposed alternatives that would reduce the risk of prejudice for his incarceration. That's why we proposed having him over potentially Zoom, you know, in a neutral background, neutral clothing. We don't want him in there in his orange jumpsuit. We would agree that he should be allowed to have a appearance that wasn't prejudicial. We offered that. We also offered a trial testimony or trial deposition that was pre-recorded. Same thing with the neutral background. That was also rejected and essentially refused to produce him. With regards to when we learned of his incarceration, I don't know if it's specifically in the record when, but I will represent to the court that it was very shortly before trial. I do believe based on when his incarceration was set to take place, and that is in the record in the motion to compel. It's one of the exhibits to that. He was incarcerated quite some time before trial, but we were only alerted to his incarceration shortly before. And therefore we had limited amount of time in which we could move to compel him, which further prejudiced plaintiff.
When the defendant moved for a directed verdict on the punitive damages issue, did you ever object that you had not been fully heard for purposes of Rule 50 because he did not testify at trial?
I believe that was kind of the core of the argument. Was that,
did you ever actually make that argument below? And yes. If you can show me where in the record.
I believe it would be in, I think it's in volume three. It's in the, actually, you know what? I think I might have it if I may. So I believe it's in volume five, pages 870. Sorry. 870 to 878 is where the argument is on that issue. And I believe it was, I don't have the specific page, but I believe it was argued in there that we hadn't been had a chance to be fully heard because he wasn't compelled to appear in person or in a deposition that was taken prior to trial. With respect to the inconsistent statement about the sunlight being in his eyes and that being the reason the crash occurred, you were correct that it wasn't actually something that came into evidence, but even if it had, the fact that he testified, or he stated in his recorded statement on volume one, page 133, he does say it was sunlight, I didn't see it, I was going my way to proceed, I didn't see anything, and it wasn't till I was already going through the light that I first saw that the light was red. And essentially what he's just admitted is, I proceeded through the light without actually confirming that I had the right of way to go. That's something that an inexperienced driver would do. That is a mistake that somebody who doesn't have the training, who doesn't know that you should maybe stop before you actually proceed through an intersection. That's the kind of mistake that an inexperienced, untrained driver would do.
Does that establish malice though? Or is that just a mistake?
Well, the fact that he knows he doesn't have the training needed. And I do want to clarify too, this isn't a case about not having a driver's license. This is a case about somebody who not only doesn't have a driver's license and a right to be on the road, but they don't have the background needed. You can not have a driver's license. I have friends who don't have driver's license, but who have driven before, probably could get a driver's license if they were to try and take the test. They just have never gone through that step. That's not the case. We don't have somebody who has years of experience. We have somebody who, though he was, I believe, 27 at the time of the crash, had only driven on Nevada roads about 20 times. He had never driven by himself. That's indicative of somebody who doesn't have the training, and he knows he doesn't have the training. That's why he said he knows he shouldn't drive if he doesn't have a license.
Ms. Allen, that section that you just read to us regarding the sunlight, did that come into evidence at trial?
It didn't, because it was part of the recorded statement.
So, and the court didn't allow that in. Was there some evidence of why he caught, you know, why he didn't see the other driver coming in his deposition?
There was. That wasn't something that came in either, though.
Okay. And the reason that information didn't come in, at least as it relates to the testimony, is that the parties agreed to redact what was contradictory to the insurance statement that the court decided not to allow into evidence. Is that right?
I believe that's correct.
Okay. How or why wouldn't that be considered invited error on the part of the plaintiff for agreeing to redact that information?
We didn't necessarily need to get in the sunlight portion of the case. That wasn't our core issue. We agreed to because there wasn't something that would be relevant in his recorded statement. It wouldn't be something that would be impeachable. But there were other issues that we felt were more important and would make more sense without the recorded statement once it was determined. And I will clarify, the final redactions, those were determined after we had the recorded statement already omitted. There were decisions, strategic decisions made to not include certain testimony because we couldn't get the recorded statement in.
Thank you.
I believe those are all of the comments I have on the issue of the judgment, unless there are any further questions on that. I'll just briefly address the interest. I will point out that Rule 68 does say that it relies, it's for applicable interest. It's not just interest from the date of the complaint or the offer to the date of judgment, it's applicable interest. And the court could determine, I apologize, the court could determine that applicable interest refers to interest that is actually accrued, actually incurred. And that would only start from the date the cost itself actually was incurred, not from just a blind date of the date of the offer of judgment, which is hundreds of days prior to the actual date the costs were incurred. And it wouldn't make sense for there to be a punishment. Again, looking at the Beatty case, it's very clear that offers of judgment are not designed to punish. They're not designed to deter. They're just designed to encourage settlement. It goes against the purpose of Rule 68 to punish Ms. Smith for the purposes of interest for something that didn't actually accrue. Unless there are any further questions, I believe that's all I have.
Any further questions?
No.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you all for your arguments and your insights into the issues before us. Before we adjourn, Judge Gibbons, do you have any comments you would like to make?
I might not be expecting them. This is Chief Judge Bola's first oral argument, presiding as the new chief. She did a fantastic job, I think. Hopefully everybody else did too.
Thank you.
And I think we should document this event.
I think we probably need a picture with everybody here because this is the first with the new.
Well, if council would be willing to take a picture afterwards, we will definitely do that. Judge Westbrook, do you have anything you would like to add?
No, but it was a lively argument. I think you both did a fabulous job, really, really do the record. And
it's tough to know things from long ago and finding exact spots in the record. And pretty amazing, council had a great grasp of the record.
Well, very good. Well, this matter will remain under submission and a decision will be issued. We will be adjourned, or we are adjourned, until the court's next scheduled oral argument, but we will join you all in the galley.
All rise. The Court of Appeals of the State of Nevada is adjourned until the next scheduled oral argument.